From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, writer Richard Ford, his new novel, Independence Day, is a sequel to his acclaimed novel, The Sports Writer. The main character, Frank Bascom, is now middle-aged, going through what he describes as the existence period, the period that comes after the big struggle, a period of small dramas and minor adjustments, when life is a high-wire act of normalcy. Also today, The Love Letter. Kathleen Shine tells us about her new novel, the story of a romance between an older woman and a younger man that begins with a mysterious love letter meant for someone else. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Price of a Child, a new historical novel about a fugitive slave by Loreen Carey. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Dr. Henry Foster's hopes of becoming Surgeon General have been put to rest in the Senate, where for the second day, supporters failed to muster the necessary backing to cut off a filibuster and bring the nomination to a final vote. Texas Republican Senator Phil Graham was one of the leaders of the effort to scuttle Foster's nomination.
I believe that he was the wrong person in the wrong job at the wrong time, and I think the public interest was served. I also believe that it was vitally important 4 months ago for a few people to stand up and say no and make it clear that they were willing to use their full rights, including filibustering this nomination.
Dr. Foster says he is not bitter despite the defeat.
Would I have liked a different outcome? Absolutely. But I remain strong and honored by being the president's choice for Surgeon General. I intend to keep fighting for the things I believe in with all of my heart.
Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole says Foster's nomination will be shelved indefinitely. No word from the White House yet on when the president might select another nominee. The former president of the United Way of America has been sentenced to 7 years in prison and 3 years on probation for looting the charity of hundreds of thousands of dollars and using the money to pay for exotic vacations and a romance with a teenage girl. William Arimony was ordered to surrender to a minimum security federal prison in 4 to 6 weeks to begin serving his sentence. Two of Arimony's former associates were also given prison terms. The three were convicted of taking about $600,000 from the United Way during a 10-year period. British Prime Minister John Major made a surprise announcement today designed to force opponents within his own governing party to, in his words, put up or shut up.
I have this afternoon tendered my resignation as leader of the Conservative Party to Sir Marcus Fox, the chairman of the 1922 Committee, and requested him to set the machinery in motion for the election of a successor. I have confirmed to Sir Marcus that I shall be a candidate in that election. If I win, I shall continue as Prime Minister and lead the party into and through the next general election. Should I be defeated, which I do not expect, I shall resign as Prime Minister and offer my successor my full support.
Major says he decided to put his job on the line because he was tired of the bickering and criticism within the Conservative Party. If by next week no challenger has stepped forward, Major will be returned to the party leadership post automatically. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up just over 38 points at 4585.49 in heavy trading of 411 million shares. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq Composite Index is up nearly 9.5 points. This is NPR. The trade negotiators from the U.S. and Japan have failed to reach any agreement in the first day of talks designed to head off stiff tariffs set to be imposed on Japanese-made luxury cars next week. In a letter to the president, over 100 economists have urged the administration to drop the threatened tariffs. The economists said the fledgling World Trade Organization would be seriously and permanently damaged if the U.S. bypasses it and imposes sanctions unilaterally. The space shuttle Atlantis has once again been cleared for launch. Technicians have repaired a leaky fuel tank, but NASA says the weather is now questionable. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Engineers replaced a faulty fitting on a helium tank in the shuttle's tail section last night, and pressure tests performed this afternoon have indicated no leaks. Atlantis is now ready to begin its historic mission, but weather forecasters say it probably won't be Friday. The Air Force predicts an 80% chance that afternoon thunderstorms will scrub the launch. The forecast for Saturday is no better. NASA has only a 7-minute launch window to send Atlantis on its way. The shuttle's orbit must allow it to catch up to the Russian space station Mir. The two ships are scheduled to dock 4 days into the mission. U.S. astronaut Norm Thagard has been living aboard Mir since March. He'll return to Earth aboard the space shuttle, along with his two Russian crewmates. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Doctors now say baseball legend Mickey Mantle is showing signs of slight organ rejection and the function of his transplanted liver is declining. Such a rejection reaction is common in liver transplant recipients. Doctors at Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas say Mantle is being given high doses of steroids to suppress his immune system and keep it from attacking the new liver. At least three people were hurt today when panels from an upper deck at Toronto's Sky Dome fell on spectators below during a game between Toronto and Milwaukee. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, writer Richard Ford, has a new novel called Independence Day that continues the story of Frank Bascom, the main character of Ford's acclaimed 1986 novel, The Sports Writer. Last week, our book critic Maureen Carrigan described The Sports Writer as one of the most moving books ever written about divorce and loss, and the nobility as well as the absurdity of just plodding along. In the new novel, Independence Day, Frank is no longer a sports writer, he's a real estate agent. His ex-wife has remarried, and his 15-year-old son appears to be turning into a delinquent. Maureen says she can't think of another American novelist besides Richard Ford who could write such an unsentimental, funny, and profound story about a man who's old enough to know better, regaining the courage to hope. In Independence Day, Frank is in his mid-40s, passing through what he describes as the existence period, the part of life that comes after the big struggle which led to the big blow-up. A period when we go along more or less self-directed and happy, but that is uneventful outside of small dramas and minor adjustments.
I was trying to describe a period of life when really you're just living your life, when you're not particularly attached to every drama that's going on around you and when you're not undergoing a crisis. And really a time in life I think of as a kind of an okay time, maybe not the best time in your life, but an okay time, the time when most people are sort of unaware of their lives. And when I tried to think of what it was, I just thought of, well, it's the nature of existence. It's when we're just existing. We're not being driven crazy by anything, or we're not euphoric. And I didn't mean and don't mean now for that period of time, because it has that name attached to it, to be a doer time or an unhappy time.
Why did you decide to bring back Frank Bascom after your 1986 novel, The Sports Writer?
Because, and I certainly never intended to do it, but I thought I had closed down all the sets on that last book and that he would speak no more. But in fact, in my notebooks in the years about 89, 90, 91, I found that I started writing in notes in my notebook in his voice, and I resisted a long time because I didn't particularly want to start thinking about a new book with Frank as its narrator again, but it just was the case that I kept looking at the world, in essence, through his fictive eyes. And finally, there was just a preponderance of notes in my notebook, and I had finished another book called Wildlife, and it was in essence, finished out of my life, and I was sort of without work to do. I'd written two novellas, and I wanted to write a novel. And I looked around and saw what I had, and I had all of this stuff, and I resisted it for a year because I thought there were a lot of pitfalls to writing a sequel, and worked and worked and worked trying to see if I really had enough stuff, and it just finally became evident that I did have enough stuff, and that's kind of, you know, what Henry James used to call a done. I'm not sure if James exactly meant that, but I felt I was given all of this stuff, and that's what a writer has to start with, what you're given, and I was given a lot of material.
You said you kept hearing his voice. What are the qualities of Frank Bascom's voice?
Gee, that's a hard question. I'm not so sure I can itemize it. Well, I think it's intimate, for one thing. And I think it is a voice which likes to address what he thinks of, and I don't want to talk about him as though I didn't make him up, because I did. He didn't exist without me.
Yeah.
that's these people who say about their own characters, well, my characters just speak to me. Well, that's a lot of baloney, actually. Writers write characters. That's how it works. But anyway, I think he has an intimacy in his voice, and I think he has a voice which likes to try to express affection, even if he doesn't always have a handy language for it. I think he has in his voice an affection for language itself, so that he will use language sometimes for its sheer pleasures.
Frank was a sports writer in The Sports Writer, and now he's a realtor.
Right.
In your new book, it seems to me that's an interesting profession to give a main character, because people are so hopeful and imaginative when they're buying a house. I mean, this house is either going to change their lives for the better or maybe ruin their lives with the mortgage. So it's a situation in life when you're always imagining how this big decision is going to totally change the course of your life.
Exactly. Exactly. Finding shelter for people is, I think, one of the most primary things we can do for each other. And as the book stipulates, where a person buys a house determines where they'll be happy and where they'll be unhappy, and what windows they'll look out of, and where they'll come home after funerals and divorces and weddings and things like that. It seems to be sort of first principle for human happiness, where people live.
You know what I thought was interesting? Frank has a son in this book, a teenage son of 15, who has begun to go astray. The son has been arrested for shoplifting condoms, and he started fighting with the security guards when they tried to nail him. And this is the third book I've read this season by important writers who I really like, who have sons in the book that are going astray: Scott Spencer, Russell Banks, and yourself. And I wonder if you think that means anything.
I don't know, because I don't have any kids.
Well, I found that interesting too. That you'd be writing about a father so carefully, not being a father yourself.
Well, I guess. One of the things that interests me as a writer is families, and if you're going to write about families, you're constantly looking for sources of drama within families. And since I was kind of a bad kid myself and was more than once caught for shoplifting, it kind of came naturally to me to write about a kid who was shoplifting. I had some personal experience, and I also knew the distress it caused my parents for kids to get caught doing what they're not supposed to be doing like that. So even though it didn't happen to me as a father, it happened to me as a son, and so it was natural to come up into my mind.
One of the dilemmas Frank has, your main character, is that he wants to be this fountain of advice to his son, but he feels like he doesn't have the language. He doesn't know what to say, what advice to give. He's thinking of giving him some books to read.
Right.
That's probably a pretty common predicament.
Well, I'm happy to know that it's a common predicament. I suppose, in a sense, it was me acting out the predicament of facing what one actually would say to a child who was in some ways distressed and who was a little estranged from you. Trying to find the lingo myself led me, in a surrogate's way, to some of the strategies of the book. Frank claims himself to be a liberal, and I think that's probably isn't that the old joke about liberals? Ask a liberal a question, he'll give you a book. Well, that's what he does. He gives his son a copy of the Declaration of Independence, and he gives his son a copy of Self-Reliance as a way of trying to open up a conversation, though it doesn't really work.
Independence Day is also a book about relationships between a man and his lover, who he's not sure quite how committed to he is, and a man and his ex-wife. And there's, some degree of talking about relationships in the book, which I think he's, reasonably reluctant to participate in. It seems to be the women who are more anxious to talk about it. Is that the kind of discussion you're also reluctant to get into in real life?
About relationships?
Yeah.
No, not at all. I think Christina and I have been married for 28 years. I think probably how life goes on intimately between the two of us is principally what we do talk about. We talk about life as shared between us all the time. No, I don't think I shy away from those kinds of conversations at all.
The question comes up in the novel, does Frank, the main character, does he know how to live, you know? And do you feel like you know how to live? Do you have like that gift, that knack? Or do you feel like other people you've seen have it and you don't?
Myself, personally?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's kind of the old college phenomenon in a sense, and maybe it gets exacerbated by ever having gone to graduate school. You constantly think that life is one place and you're someplace else, that you're always waiting to start life, and life is just kind of a little bit offshore. But as for myself, whether I know how to live life personally or not, I at least will agree to you that I'm living it. Which is, I don't think that I'm not living it, or I don't think that the good life or the engaged life is someplace else from where I am. I mean, I'm spending my life trying to be a good writer and writing books, and so I'm very much nose up to my life in that sense. And I think Christina and I, and I know she is too, but I think we both feel like we're sort of very close to the nap of our lives, which has nothing to do with whether or not we're successful at living it, or whether it makes us ecstatic day to day, year in, year out. But I think I'm living it. It would have to be probably in the words of somebody else to know if I'm doing it good or not.
My guest is Richard Ford. He has a new novel called Independence Day. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Richard Ford is my guest. He has a new novel. It's called Independence Day, and it's a sequel to his 1986 novel, The Sports Writer. Your father, I think he died when you were about 16.
Right.
I know during some of his life he was a salesman. I believe he sold starch.
Exactly.
On the road. Was he the kind of salesman who had to survive on his verbal skills to convince his clients to buy something, or was he not that kind of salesman?
Well, that's a funny thing you should ask, because he used to, part of his territory was down in what they used to call the Evangeline country, which is over on the west side of the Atchafalaya River in Louisiana, and where in the 50s at least, and probably still today, people spoke French, and that patois French, and he would go into these little towns like Thibodaux and Ville Platte and St. Francisville, and he would go in there, and I think kind of sell himself to people who he didn't share a language with, but I think he would kind of fake it sometimes. He would sort of speak to them in a patois of his own, and they would speak back to him. And basically, what he did was sell himself to them by not so much his verbal skills, but by his willingness to try.
Did you ever watch him in action on the road?
Many times. Many times. In fact, I can still drive over there, particularly also up in the Delta in Mississippi, where I sometimes live. I can go back to those places where he traveled, and he used to take me inside these wholesale grocery company warehouses, and I would just stand beside him as he would do his business. And as I say, I can go back to those places now. There, some of them are still around. It's quite memorable to me.
What was it like growing up knowing that your father sold starch? I mean, starch isn't a really big part of a young person's life.
Starch is not too sexy.
No.
Well, it was the only job he ever had. And we thought, my family used to always say that my father was a guy who had a job during the Depression. He got a job working for the same company, the Faultless Starch Company in Kansas City, Missouri, the same company that Huey Long used to sell starch for in the 20s. And they were always so thrilled my mother and father that he had kept his job through the 30s and through the 40s and through the 50s. And the fact that he sold starch rather than, you know, something more high profile or appealing never was an issue in our life at all. I think maybe amongst his salesman pals, there was a lot of joking about starch. You know, there's salesmen, I guess the idea of a traveling salesman joke doesn't still doesn't exist anymore. But I'm sure there were a lot of nice bawdy jokes about selling starch. And you can imagine.
I can see where you're leading.
You can imagine what they would be about. and I think that was a source of humor. My father was a very mirthful guy. And so I think he thought selling starch was his job. And he came out of a time in American life when if you had a job, you didn't question what kind. Upward mobility was not really a matter of choosing among a lot of alternatives. He had a job. He loved it. He worked hard at it. And that was it. I think in a way, frankly, you know, that has led me to some of the preoccupations of my own work, which is not surprising. A character really doesn't become workable for me. And I don't want to say real, because characters never really become real for me. But a character doesn't become workable for me until I can posit what it is she or he does for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And once I get that little anchorage established in a character's the sort of fascicle of life that they have, then I can begin to imagine them more completely.
When your father died when you were 16, did you become like a more responsible person then, or did you get into more trouble in the short period right afterwards?
No, I had been in a lot of trouble in the short periods just before, and it's a very peculiar thing in a sense. I had gotten in trouble with the police for stealing with a pal of mine in Little Rock, rather in Jackson, where I grew up, Mississippi. And my father was a traveling salesman, and so he was gone a lot and come home on the weekends. And my mother always tried to make the weekends be rather nice, and the affairs of daily life were sort of set aside while my father was home. But when I got in trouble with the police, my father had to come along and take an interest in this. And he was, I remember, so kind about it. He said to me, "Well," he said, "you know, you'll this is bad, and you're going to have to be on probation. You got to go to court and things like that." And but I remember very distinctly, and my mother was the same. I don't want to include her out of this, but he was extremely sympathetic to me. He sort of seemed to know that what I was doing was not good, that it wasn't the worst thing. And then 2 weeks after this happened, he died. And that's what it left me with. His death. It left me with a sort of conviction that I had to do more right than I had been doing up to date. And so I actually kind of started getting my act together, because my mother said to me after my father died, she said, "You know, I'm going to have to go to work now. You're 16 years old. You're going to have to take care of yourself a lot more than you've been taking care of yourself." And so that was true. I knew it was true. And so I did.
Did you have to get a job?
Well, I had a job.
Uh-huh.
We worked.
What'd you do?
Oh, I sat groceries at the A&P, and I did all the things that boys could do in those days. I did everything that I could do to earn some money. I mean, and I don't want to misrepresent our life. It wasn't that we were poor, because we weren't, but it would have never occurred to me, nor would it have ever occurred to my family, that when I got above 14, which was the age that when you could go to work, that I wouldn't have a job. I just did.
I know you spent some time, I guess maybe this was after your father's death, living with your grandparents.
Right.
Who, did they own a motel or run a motel?
They ran a big hotel in Little Rock. And after my father died, actually quite a while before he died, because he had been sick with heart trouble for years before that, I spent a lot of my growing up period, particularly in the summers, in the Marion Hotel in Little Rock, Arkansas. And for a growing, you know, for a period of adolescence, that's quite a risque place to grow up.
Did we're risque because there's a lot of people who go there for their quickie afternoon flings? Or?
That and just a lot of general license occurs in a hotel. It was a big hotel. It's gone now. They imploded it in Little Rock back about 20 years ago. They wouldn't do it now, because it was a wonderful old building. But all kinds of political shenanigans and, as you say, the quick afternoon stop off, but you know, also a good deal of violence. People going into hotel rooms and committing murders, and going into hotel rooms committing suicides, fights, all kinds of mayhem.
Well, this must have made you think that life was very eventful.
Yes, it did, actually. And I loved to go there. Every time I could get a chance, I would go up to Little Rock and stay with my grandparents, because you never could tell what was going to happen.
What I find particularly intriguing about this is that one of the things I've always liked about hotels and motels is that, well, at their best, they're a way to get some respite from regular life. You're in this kind of limbo, you know, and someone comes in and cleans your room and makes the bed.
Exactly.
All the responsibilities that come with having an apartment or a house, you don't have while you're in this hotel.
That's exactly right.
And you're probably removed from everything else in your life also, unless you're at a business conference.
That's exactly right.
So to live in that environment where everybody around you has gotten away from regular life, but that is your regular life, is pretty interesting.
Well, it creates in you a kind of dual sense of permanence and transience, equally competing for persuasive power in your life.
Right.
And it did me, in fact. I mean, I don't know if there's any time in the life that I'm happier than the first 25 minutes after I've checked into a hotel. As you say, all of those things that you just described, all of those senses of irresponsibility and come down on you wonderfully. Christina and I think that one of the things that we do is in Montana is that we go hunting sometimes, and we just stay in little cheap motels way out in the middle of nowhere, and I think it's the happiest we ever are, for the very reasons that you say.
Now, did you have a writer's interest in imagining the lives of all the people staying at the hotel while you were there?
Well, I didn't have to imagine it.
Right.
I was the manager's son.
Oh,
I could,
all right.
If I wanted to know what they were doing, I could jolly well find out what they were doing, because I knew all the bellboys. I knew all the maids. One of my first jobs was to be a room service waiter. And can you imagine what a 17-year-old room service waiter sees?
What do you see?
Well, you see the governor sometimes where he's not supposed to be. You see the head of the highway patrol sometimes where he's not supposed to be. And it was always strange, because I would... This was not even in my grandfather's hotel, but another hotel. I really grew up in the hotel business in that sense. And I was kind of a naive kid in some ways, and I would sometimes take somebody's breakfast to their rooms, and the man who opened the door would be a man I knew. And maybe he wouldn't recognize me right away as being the kid with the white jacket on. But something in me always made him say, "Oh, hi, Mr. So-and-so. Remember me? I'm Richard Ford. I'm Ben Shelley's grandson." And there was always kind of an awful moment, which I finally, by dint of repetition, quit doing. but I couldn't resist when I saw somebody I recognized saying hello and introducing myself. I guess I'm my father's son in that way.
Did you know the meaning of the word discretion when when you were at the hotel?
No, I didn't know. But I learned it, though.
Did people ever pay you not to say anything?
No. No, they may have wished they had later, when they saw books that I wrote 25 years later, in which their lives were perhaps reflected. Though I never used anybody's name. Yes, I learned discretion.
Richard Ford, thank you so much for talking
with
us.
My pleasure entirely.
Richard Ford, his new novel is called Independence Day. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the intoxicating effect of a love letter. We talk with Kathleen Shine about her new novel, The Love Letter. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Price of a Child, a new historical novel by Lorraine Carey, based on the true story of a fugitive slave who found freedom in Philadelphia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. British Prime Minister John Major has resigned as leader of his governing Conservative Party to force a showdown with his opponents. Major says he expects to win the leadership vote and to continue as Prime Minister. From London, reporter Mike Moran has more.
Mr. Major has been under a lot of pressure from within his party on several fronts, but mostly because the polls have shown him dropping consistently for about 2 years now, to the point where they're almost doomed to lose the next election. So Mr. Major has said essentially exactly these words, put up or shut up, to his opponents, and he's told them he will stand in a new election for the head of the Conservative Party. This, of course, does not mean he has resigned as Prime Minister. However, he went on to say that should he lose that election, he will resign and give his full support to whoever his successor is.
Mike Moran reporting from London. For a second day, supporters of Surgeon General nominee Dr. Henry Foster failed to muster enough votes to cut off a filibuster and bring Foster's name up for a final vote. That effectively defeats his nomination. The Military Base Closure Commission has voted to shut down the major Cold War missile field at Grand Forks, North Dakota, and the huge McClellan Air Force Base in California. But the panel rejected recommendations to close two Air Force laboratories, including one in Rome, New York, and residents there are celebrating the victory. From member station WRVA in Oswego, New York, Chris Ulanowski reports.
Closing Rome Lab would have been a severe blow to a struggling local economy. Following the closing 2 years ago of Rome's Griffiths Air Force Base and the loss of 8,000 military and civilian jobs, local leaders made the Air Force Super Lab the cornerstone of the community's economic revival, with the hope of luring private investment to the area. Many Rome residents gathered around their radios to listen to the commission's announcement. Evelyn Kasich at the Rome Chamber of Commerce said everyone was ecstatic. At City Hall, a worker said the decision was outstanding, adding it was great to see something go Rome's way. They agreed Rome Lab and its 800 jobs were spared because the Pentagon's projected cost savings did not add up. For National Public Radio, I'm Chris Ulanowski in Oswego, New York.
Officials at a New York hospital say a neurosurgeon mistakenly operated on the healthy part of a cancer patient's brain. The doctor at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center had pulled the pictures from the wrong patient's skull. That doctor's surgical privileges have been suspended. The Justice Department is reportedly widening its investigation of Microsoft's planned online service. The New York Times says the government is trying to determine whether Microsoft will have an unfair advantage in the online market by bundling its service along with its new Windows 95 software. On Wall Street, stock prices were higher. The Dow Industrial Average gained more than 42 points to close at a new record high. This is NPR. A new report from the Centers for Disease Control says there was a 58% increase in cases of Lyme disease in the U.S. last year. The incidence of the disease hit a record high. A doctor with the National Center for Infectious Diseases blames the increase on better reporting, as well as a rise in the number of ticks that spread the disease and the field mice that carry them. Lyme disease causes flu-like symptoms and can affect the heart and joints. The CIA has discovered that China is shipping missile-making components to Iran and Pakistan. The government report has been circulated among policymakers, according to the New York Times. From member station WNYC, Richard Hake reports.
The CIA's report suggests that over the last year, dozens, maybe even thousands of missile guidance systems and tools have been sent from China to Iran. The New York Times quotes the report and says Tehran could greatly improve the accuracy of its Scud missiles. The CIA is also worried that Pakistan will build M-11 missiles since parts have been delivered there over the last 3 months. Senior Clinton administration officials say these shipments could violate an international missile accord. The director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency told the paper that sanctions are being considered. It was nearly 2 years ago the United States banned certain high-tech sales to China after it was learned that missile components were being shipped out. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Hake in New York.
The 1,800 passengers whose vacations were stopped dead in the water when their cruise ship, the Celebration, became disabled in the Bahamas have finally arrived back in Miami. They'd been picked up earlier in the week by another cruise ship. The mother of actor Macaulay Culkin has obtained a court order granting her temporary custody of the child star and five siblings. 14-year-old Culkin had earned millions of dollars for his movie roles. Patricia Bentrup says Culkin's father is accused of physical abuse and abandoning the family home. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Has anyone ever sent you a passionate love letter about how life is drained of all color and meaning when you're not in the room? In the new novel, The Love Letter, Helen, a middle-aged divorced woman, receives an anonymous love letter accidentally in the mail. Although she knows she's not the person the letter was intended for, she's intoxicated by it. She becomes obsessed with trying to figure out who wrote the letter and who was supposed to get it. In a series of comic errors, the letter inspires a romance between Helen and a much younger man who works in the bookstore that Helen owns. This novel about love, love letters, and literature was written by my guest Kathleen Shine. She's also the author of the satiric novels Alice in Bed and Rameau's Niece, and she writes humor pieces for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. I asked her to read the love letter that sets everything in motion in her new novel.
Dear Goat, how does one fall in love? Do you trip? Do you stumble, lose your balance, and drop to the sidewalk? Graze your knee? Graze your heart? Do you crash to the stony ground? Is there a precipice from which you float over the edge forever? I know I'm in love when I see you. I know when I long to see you. Not a muscle has moved. Leaves hang unruffled by any breeze. The air is still. I have fallen in love without taking a step. When did this happen? I haven't even blinked. I'm on fire. Is that too banal for you? It's not, you know. You'll see. It's what happens. It's what matters. I'm on fire. I no longer eat. I forget to eat. Food looks silly to me, irrelevant, if I even notice it. But I notice nothing. My thoughts are full and raging, a house full of brothers, related by blood, feuding blood feuds. I threw the book out the window last night. I tried to forget. You are all wrong for me, I know it, but I no longer care for my thoughts unless they're thoughts of you. When I'm close to you, in your presence, I feel your hair brush my cheek when it does not. I look away from you sometimes, then I look back. When I tie my shoes, when I peel an orange, when I drive my car, when I lie down each night without you, I remain, as ever, Ram.
What effect does this love letter have on Helen, who accidentally ends up with it?
Well, it's very confusing at first and startling and I think frightening in some way, partly because it's a mystery. She doesn't know who sent it. She doesn't know to whom it was sent. It's very, very personal, and yet it's not. It doesn't relate to her. And yet she's drawn into some kind of very passionate, personal affair. And so I think it's both titillating and makes her feel guilty at the same time and makes her feel like a voyeur. And she starts imagining, looking at all of her customers and looking at the people who work for her and thinking about them in a new light.
There's a 20-year-old man who works for the summer in Helen's
right.
bookstore. What effect does the letter have on him when he comes upon it accidentally?
Well, you know, he has this boss who's very powerful and flirtatious, Helen. And she's a tough cookie, and he's kind of bowled over by her and resentful at the same time. But she is very flirtatious, and her way of controlling people is a kind of seduction, not necessarily sexual, but it's the way she sells books. It's the way she operates in the world. And this letter, I think, when he sees it accidentally, and he assumes it's for Helen or from Helen, that it has something to do with Helen, and it suddenly puts her in a completely new light, or it crystallizes something that perhaps he's been feeling subconsciously for a while, and he thinks of her as someone involved in sex and love and passion. And at that point, he falls for her.
What did you draw on when you wrote this letter?
Well, I actually received a letter when I was, it was in the summer, and I was just beginning the book, and I had no idea of putting any letters in the book. It was just going to be about a bookstore and about a flirt, and that's all I really knew. I didn't even know who she was flirting with or who she was going to fall in love. I knew nothing. I just knew the premise. And I was sitting on my bed, and I had all this mail. I was at my mother's house, and all this mail had been forwarded to me from New York. And I had tons and tons of mail. And I opened it all up, and, you know, it was interesting, boring, whatever, things from relatives, from publishers, editors, all kinds of things. And when I was done looking at everything, I noticed this very weird, crumpled up, twisted piece of paper, which clearly had been accidentally shoved into one of the envelopes, picked up with something. And I opened it, and it was a letter. And it said, "Dear Goat," and it was signed, as ever, Ram, and it was typed. And it was not a love letter. It was an answer. It was a letter answering another letter. It was a letter after the person who'd written this one had been broken up with. It was an answer to a kiss-off letter. And it was very upsetting. It was very passionate and very, very bitter, very literary. You know, all these allusions to T.S. Eliot and what page on what edition you should look for which insult and things like that. And there was stuff. I mean, I knew it wasn't for me because there was stuff about alarm clocks and, you know, all these allusions to personal little incidents that had occurred between these two people. I didn't know what they were. But even so, I felt that somehow it had come to me. It was mine. I was guilty in some way. And I also thought, well, now which of my friends is having an affair? Because this is the letter of two people having some kind of illicit affair. And then I couldn't tell if it was from a man to a woman to a man to a man, or a woman to a woman. All I could tell was this letter came from someone in New York. I knew it wasn't from my brother in California. It wasn't a California letter. This is the only identification I could make.
Did you ever find out?
No, I've never found out. It tortured me for days. I didn't tell anyone. I was very embarrassed because I thought, what if it is one of my friends and I know this secret about them that I don't want to know? And I became obsessed with it. And finally, at one point, I just tore it into shreds.
Like your character does in the book.
Just like my character. And I threw it away. And then I called my husband and I told him about it after I'd torn it up. And he said, "Are you crazy? Get it back. It's really interesting." And I said, no, it's bad. I don't want to know." And then I was sitting there thinking and I thought, oh, this is a novel. This is a mystery. And this is my book.
Did you ever write or get passionate love letters?
Certainly not recently.
Well, you've been married a long time.
Yeah. I did. I guess I yes. And one of these cases was sort of interesting, I think, because I guess it was my senior year of high school, and I went away for the summer. It was sometime around then, and I had a boyfriend who was Israeli, and was living in Connecticut. He was blind, and he was there to get operations on his eyes, hoping that they would get better. And I went away for the summer to Italy to some summer program, and I missed him terribly. And I would write these very passionate love letters, which, of course, had to be read out loud to him by the family he was staying with, who were just these regular suburban people, you know, and it's very, very nice, obviously, to take in this guy. And so here was this nice middle-class, middle-aged, regular, conventional woman who had to read, you know, these hot and heavy teenage love letters to this Israeli. He was furious, and of course I was, you know, when you're that age, you just don't think and don't care. He was really very annoyed, and then he'd have to dictate his letters back to me, so he would sort of make fun of me. So that was That was very interesting. And later, I used to write. I had a boyfriend who lived in another city, and we would write. And I drew on some of those letters for this book. I still had them. They're quite funny.
My guest is Kathleen Shine. Her new novel is called The Love Letter. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with novelist Kathleen Shine. Her new book is called The Love Letter. The main character, Helen, was in a car accident when she was young, when she was 16.
Right.
I know that also happened to you.
Right.
When you were young. I'd like you to read the paragraph about the accident in your novel, The Love Letter.
Okay. At 16, the accident had made her merely angry. Lying in the hospital in the emergency room, as doctors tried to staunch the flow of blood from her lacerated face, she had wondered if her belt, her favorite belt, was ruined. It was so inconvenient, a car crash. How dare this happen? She had almost died, but all she knew, as she almost died, was a prickly irritation, as if death were a curfew, a punishment she could talk her parents out of. Now, 25 years later, she understood that she had almost died. She had even gotten used to the idea. But familiarity bred horror, not contempt. Death lived in the world. Disaster descended from the mountaintop. They were real, death and disaster. Worse, they were plausible. If one let one's wild teenage boyfriend drive one around a sharp curve on a country road at night at 70 miles an hour, one went through a windshield. Therefore, one drove oneself. This was Helen's credo. It extended beyond automobiles. She could have crocheted it on a pillow, hung a sign in the store, tattooed it on her chest. I'll drive.
What happened to you when you were in your car accident?
Pretty much the same thing. I've never written about the car accident. I've never used it, although I've often thought of using it. But it really took a long time to kind of settle in. I was 16 and, you know, I was out with some friends and we were driving too fast. And I went through the windshield. And as I left the driveway, as they picked me up, my father said, "Wear your seatbelt." And I said, "Oh, Dad," and didn't put it on and went through the windshield. I broke my neck. In fact, I broke the same vertebrae that Christopher Reeves broke.
But,
whoa. Yeah, but mine, I think, just cracked. So I was in traction for a month, and then I was okay. And my face was all cut up, and I really actually almost died. And I literally remember lying there thinking, I hope my belt is okay. I hope it's not too bloody. And then having a fit when I wasn't allowed to go to Woodstock. I mean, I was in the hospital with things screwed into my skull called the Crutchfield tongs holding me down in traction. And I wanted to go to Woodstock, and I kept saying, "Put me in a body cast. I can go. My friends will put me in the back of a van. It'll be fine." And my doctor said, "Your neck is broken." And I said, "No, it's not. I broke my top two vertebrae." And he said, "Your vertebrae are your neck. You have a broken neck."
Well, your first novel, Alice in Bed, was about a teenager who spends about a year in the hospital with this mysterious and very painful paralysis of her legs.
Right. And that is autobiographical. What it turned out later it was from was taking cortisone for something else that I had, and it was a side effect. It was really nightmarish. And that book is kind of a black comedy, as well it should be. It was quite something. But, you know, writing about it was really sort of fun.
You know, your character, after her car accident, her motto is that she's going to drive. What did she say?
I'll drive.
I'll drive. So were you changed in that way, too, that you wanted to be more in control?
Well, I wanted to be in more control, but the difference between me and Helen, my character, is that Helen actually is in more control.
You just want to be.
I see myself as a kind of lazy perfectionist. I remember sitting in my living room one day, and I was looking up, and the curtains on the curtain rod were cockeyed. Like, one side was way over to the side where it shouldn't have been. And I thought, that's awful, and that's driving me crazy. And then I thought, that has been driving me crazy for 2 years, and I haven't touched it. And so that's the difference between Helen and me. Helen would have gotten on a ladder and fixed it, and I just stare at it and think, that's a problem.
Kathleen Shine, her new novel is called The Love Letter. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have news from the U.S. Senate of the second attempt in 2 days to break the filibuster against the nomination of Dr. Henry Foster. And once again, the attempt failed. This probably means that Dr. Foster's chances of becoming Surgeon General of the United States are nil. Also on today's program, we'll hear about the surprising decision today by British Prime Minister John Major to step down as leader of the Conservative Party. And that prompts a fight to succeed him, or for him to succeed himself, and we'll hear why he's done that. Also on today's program, Mean Mice and the 60 elements that make up the sound of the Batmobile.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Loreen Carey's acclaimed 1991 memoir, Black Ice, recounted her experiences as an African-American student in a predominantly white New England prep school during the 1970s. Now in her first novel, The Price of a Child, Carey describes another kind of outsider experience, that of a fugitive slave trying to make a place for herself in 19th century Philadelphia. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
I teach Benjamin Franklin's autobiography nearly every year, and unlike most of my students, I've always been willing to put up with Franklin's self-congratulatory lectures on the virtues of frugality and hard work, just to get to the vivid passage where he describes entering Philadelphia for the first time as a 17-year-old runaway. Franklin writes, "I was dirty from my journey. My pockets were stuffed out with shirts and stockings. I knew no soul, nor where to look for lodging. I was very hungry, and my whole stock of cash consisted of a Dutch dollar and about a shilling in copper." Before 24 hours passed, Franklin encountered his future wife, found a job at a printer's shop, and was well on his way to earning a fortune, harnessing electricity, and orchestrating a revolution. Only in America, right? But a century after Franklin took the city by storm, Philadelphia had become a crucial stop on the Underground Railroad. lots of other American runaways came to that city in search of the freedom they hadn't been granted by the new nation Franklin helped to found. Loreen Carey's stirring novel, The Price of a Child, is based on the true story of one of those more fortunate pilgrims, a slave named Jane Johnson, who arrived in Philadelphia and issued her own one-woman Declaration of Independence. Carey's novel opens in 1855. Jane Johnson, here renamed Ginny Pryor, is a cook who's accompanying her master, a diplomat, on a sea voyage from Virginia to New York and then on to Nicaragua. Two of Ginny's children are with them, but her baby, who's also the master's child, has been kept behind on the plantation to ensure that Ginny won't try to bolt. A once-in-a-lifetime opportunity presents itself, however, when the travelers are delayed in abolitionist-friendly Philadelphia. At the city docks, Ginny hardens her heart against the memory of her baby and stages a brazen daylight escape. With the encouragement of a few Quakers and ship's porters, she and her children simply walk away from their master. As a historical novelist who's trying to paint visions of things past, Carey is more accomplished at murals than she is at individual portraits. Even though we watch Ginny settle into a prosperous black family, fall in love, and become a stump speaker for the abolitionist movement, she's a hard character to know. It's almost as though her acquired distrust of strangers puts constraints on her relationships with the reader. Ginny never quite lets her guard down. But The Price of a Child does an astonishing job of conjuring up mid-19th century black life in Philadelphia. We learn about societies advocating emigration to Africa and Canada, and about magazines like Freedom's Journal that publish the names of blacks who informed on others' escape plans. We wander through stinking alleys and into parlors where colored people of quality debate the wisdom of getting involved with the Underground Railroad. No doubt, this is a different Philadelphia than the earlier one Ben Franklin evoked. But in the honor it pays to the possibilities Americans have created and sustained under the most despairing of circumstances, The Price of a Child electrifies, even without the kite.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Price of a Child by Loreen Carey. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Kenesha Baker is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of New Passages, Mapping Your Life Across Time, the new book from Gail Sheehy, author of Passages. This is NPR, National Public Radio.